sitting on my lap on my phone with a laptop and the internet and to read from.
That was not from the laptop computer.
That mic isn't up.
I'm Alexander R. Cohen. I'm a doctoral student in philosophy here. And I'd like to ask you what you would say to the claim that the adaptationist view of evolution, as expounded particularly by yourself and Daniel Dennett, and particularly as augmented by Dennett's theory of the intentional stance, adds up to a reinvention of a deity in the form of a sort of natural providence, not clearly a scriptural type of deity, but a deity compatible with a lot of what we call natural theology.
Right. Did everybody hear that? To what extent does the adaptationist view of evolution, as propounded by me and Daniel Dennett, add up to a kind of looking towards a new sort of deity? I don't think it does it to the slightest degree. The difference is that a deity is a supernatural being who consciously plans things, deliberately and consciously and intelligently designs them. Adaptation by natural selection is a completely unconscious process which occurs by an interplay of random chance, random mutation, and non-random survival and reproduction. It is entirely devoid of any kind of foresight, any kind of planning, any kind of deliberation, any kind of intention in the conscious and deliberate sense. It is true, as the question says, Daniel Dennett has invented a phrase, the intentional stance. But Dennett's intentional stance is merely a way of talking about the consequences of natural selection. When an animal needs to survive in a complex world, that complex world includes predators and includes social companions and would-be mates, which are very complex things. It is a useful rule of thumb, using the phrase that I mentioned earlier, to behave as if the creature had intentions, or even an inadvertent, even an inanimate object had intentions. That's the next meaning of the intentional stance, and it doesn't mean anything to do with the deity, anything to do with the supernatural. So my answer to the question is, it's an interesting question, but no.
I'm curious about the title of your book, that you use the word delusion rather than illusion. Because certainly from your writing and from what you've said today, illusion seems to me fit much better. That is, the idea of God might well arise as one of your Darwinian mistakes, whereas delusion sounds more like mental illness as opposed to something that might arise, say, through natural selection.
Yes, it's a fair point. Delusion does suggest some association with mental illness. when only one or a few people suffer from a false belief, we can call it a mental illness. When millions of people suffer from the same erroneous view of the world, we don't necessarily call it a mental illness, because simply too many people suffer from it. However, I'm not sure that there's all that much difference. I think there is a possibly good case to be made that religion is indeed a mental illness. Possibly you could call it an infectious one. I describe it as analogous to a virus, a computer virus, usually transmitted longitudinally down the generations, but it can be transmitted horizontally from particularly virulent infective agents.
I think rationality is reason enough not to believe in a deity, but you made an extra utilitarian case in your book about delusion to say that religion is bad, more bad than good, it has bad effects. So I just want to So it's a small critique of one argument you make. You said, you know, people like Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr., their actions, their religion was incidental to their good actions. Yet at the same in the same way you say, you know, when you talk about religious nutcases like terrorists, their religion was instrumental to their actions. Don't you see a contradiction in that?
Yes, it's a fair point. First, I should say I'm much more confident of the part of the book which discusses why I think there is no God than I am of the bit which says that religion is bad. Actually, the book doesn't say that religion is bad with anything like the vigor as a film, Mutual War Evil, which I presented on Channel 4 in Britain, and which will probably not be shown in this country. but it is available as a DVD, and you can find it on richarddawkins.net, along with a lot of other stuff, which I recommend. I think the questioner does make a good point. I think the way I'm asking him is this. I don't believe that the way to decide whether religion is bad or good is to tot up, to add up lists of good people and bad people who may or may not have been religious or non-religious. I don't think you have a sort of table down this side of the page with Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi and Jesus and the good people down there, and then bad people down there like the Crusaders and Pastor Ted Haggard and various others. of adding up lists of good people and bad people. I think rather we should look at in general reasons why the profession of faith, why religious faith, might be expected to make people either good or bad. And I can see reasons why faith, which means belief in the absence of evidence — if you want evidence, then you don't need faith, you just use the evidence to base your belief. Faith is belief without evidence. And I do think that that is potentially a recipe for badness, for the following reason. If you are brought up to think that faith is a virtue, and that almost to believe that the less evidence there is for your belief, the more virtuous you are in holding it, and that actually is the case with quite a lot of religions, then, although most people don't push it to the extreme, when there are extremists around who have been taught that as a value in early life, people who are perhaps predisposed to violence, they are not amenable to argument. The whole point about faith is that it's not amenable to argument. I know because I know because I know. I believe because I believe because I believe. I believe because it is impossible. If you have been trained that faith is immune to argument, immune to evidence, immune to contradiction, then if you have decided on the basis of your faith, on the basis of revelation or authority or scripture, that the right thing, the thing that your God wants you to do is go on a suicide mission, then you are going to be undissuadable of that in a way that somebody whose beliefs are based on evidence will not be undissuadable. There is a huge difference between people whose belief is based on evidence, who know what it will take to change their mind, and people whose beliefs are based on faith, who will not change their mind under any circumstances. And so I do think that, never mind about making lists of good people and bad people, faith is dangerous. Teaching children that faith is a virtue, teaching children that there's something really good about believing something when there's no evidence, is a dangerous thing to do. Not in everybody by any means, but teaching everybody that and instilling into all of us, whether we are secular or religious, a kind of unwarranted respect for faith is asking for trouble, because if faith gets into the wrong minds, as it manifestly does, then there's trouble. I do think there are other things which are bad about religion as well. As a scientist, I'm particularly concerned with the way it teaches people not to be inquiring, not to be skeptical, not to constantly be searching for new knowledge, but to accept what is written down in a book as the final truth. That is anti-scientific, and I think it's ultimately anti-humanity as well.
I'd like to hear your thoughts on homosexuality within the evolutionary theoretical framework, stepping aside of Christian religion for a second. And I'm just wondering if it bothers you that evolutionary theory tends to naturalize heterosexuality, even when there is evidence that there are hundreds of species of animals, for example, non-human animals, exhibiting queer behavior, as well as evolutionary arguments that say, you know, homosexual human beings can contribute to raising offspring and so on. The implication is still that heterosexuality is the norm, and I'm just wondering if the kind of ethical, political implications of that are something that concern you.
Well, look, I think the important thing is that whether it's natural or not, whether heterosexuality is the norm or not, whether there are hundreds or thousands of species in which homosexual behavior is found, is completely irrelevant to the question of whether it's right or wrong for individual humans to do whatever they want to do behind the privacy of their own closed doors. So, you virtually never find any secular moralist condemning what people do in private. It is always religious moralists who are constantly fussing about, constantly worrying away what other people do in private. As Sam Harris said in one of his excellent books, Letter to a Christian Nation, your chief is addressed to American Christians. Your chief preoccupation seems to be that the creator of the universe is worried about what people do when naked. As though the creator of the universe didn't have better things to worry about. Now, I think it's perfectly reasonable to say that heterosexuality is the norm. Heterosexuality is heterosexual behavior, is what gives rise to babies. And babies are what it's all about in the Darwinian world. I talked today about morality as a byproduct, and I call it a blessed byproduct. Homosexuality, I would also see as a byproduct of heterosexual desire. And if you like it, it's blessed too. It's up to you. It doesn't matter whether it's natural or normal or sanctioned by Darwinism, or whether it's present in hundreds of species. I'm not even that interested whether it's present in hundreds of species. What I am interested in is the freedom for people to enjoy whatever sex life they choose to enjoy, as long as it doesn't harm others. Self-sacrificial Christ of the New Testament, as opposed to the vindictive monster of the Old. Well, certainly Jesus was an enormous improvement. And in many ways, Jesus was far ahead of his time. In some respects, you would have to go right forward to such figures as Gandhi and Martin Luther King, who were already mentioned, to find his equal as a moralist. However, you use the phrase self-sacrificial. This alludes to the central dogma of the New Testament, invented by St. Paul, which is that Jesus' entire mission in life was to redeem the sins of mankind, in particular the sin of Adam. And the idea that somebody, the Son of God in this case, had to be tortured hideously and executed in expiation of the sins of Adam, who never existed, of the sins of all of humanity, including the great majority of humanity who were yet to exist and who might, for all anybody knew, decide not to sin. It is a punishment theory which, by modern moral standards, would be considered obnoxious. The idea that somebody should be punished for other people's sins, thereby removing those sins, is a pretty ropey kind of punishment theory. It also would seem to us, if we weren't brought up in it, fucking mad. Who was God trying to impress? Presumably himself, as he hung there suffering on the cross. What an utterly obnoxious theory it is. And what a good thing it is, because never Jesus' theory was in heaven. Of course, the first few chapters of Plato's Republic, there's a pair of characters whose names I can't recall.
Well, in your words, are you perhaps too close to the microphone?
Anyway, so for the first few chapters of Plato's Republic, there's a pair of characters whose names I can't recall, but they pose the following question to Socrates about morality, which seems to be in line with morality arising as a Darwinian misfiring. And they say basically, Socrates, isn't what we want to get the benefits of being moral, i.e. the kin selection, and even though of course I'm going to use those terms, and don't we really want to get those benefits while at the same time realizing that we can benefit ourselves by cheating the system at times, by taking advantage when there's no reasonable chance that we'll be caught and thereby get both sides of the coin? Isn't that what the intelligent person will do once he understands what this morality is all about? And then, of course, the rest of the book is Socrates' reply, and it has to do with absolute good and the human soul and things like that, getting things in order. How would you respond to that charge as someone who understands what morality is all about?
Right. I think I understood you to be saying that that Socrates, as related by Plato, in a sense, anticipated the principles of reciprocal altruism, but also pointed out that any smart person would outwit the system by cheating, and that, of course, is right. And yet, the odd thing is that many of us don't. Many of us are actually nicer than we should be, judging by the standards of evolutionary biology and game theory and reciprocal altruism and that kind of thing. And I think that's right, but in a way, that's where my misfiring comes in. It is true that by the strict Darwinian accounting rules, we would expect a lot more cheating and reneging on bargains and that kind of thing. But the misfiring theory that I advanced, remember, is only a rule of thumb. And the rule of thumb said, be nice to everybody that you meet, because in ancestral times, everybody that you meet would have included people that you're going to see again and again who you couldn't get away with cheating, with cheating against. And so there's a kind of lust which is analogous to sexual lust and which still works, just as sexual lust still works in the presence of contraception. So the lust to be nice, it just feels like a passionate desire to be nice, a passionate desire to feel sympathy, a passionate desire to remove other people's or other animals' suffering, to do to others what you would wish that they would do to you, the golden rule. So that's how I get out of the difficulty that you've raised, not perhaps entirely satisfactorily, but on the whole, I think I am satisfied by that explanation. One more question.
What do you think is human capacity for faith, and what drives people to want to have faith, to want to go against logic in such a huge fashion, to want to be irrational?
Right. What drives people to have
to have faith. Well, I do have a chapter on this in The God Delusion, which again invokes a kind of byproduct theory. I don't actually think that religious faith has survival value in itself, but I think once again it's a byproduct of something else which does have or did have. It could be a number of different things, psychological predispositions, which in other contexts would have had Darwinian survival value, and which manifest themselves in the form of religious faith under the right cultural conditions. The kind of thing I'm thinking of is another of those rules of thumb, a rule of thumb perhaps especially prominent in the child brain, which says, believe what your parents tell you. Believe what your parents tell you is a good rule of thumb, just like sexual lust is a good rule of thumb. Believe what your parents tell you is a good rule of thumb if you're a child, because parents have wisdom gained from experience and gained from their parents, which if you as a child try to test by an experiment might be fatal. And the kind of rule of thumb, parental advice I'm thinking of is don't walk over a cliff. Don't step in a fire. Children should not learn that kind of wisdom by experiment. Natural selection would naturally have built into the child brain the rule of thumb, believe what your parents tell you. But a brain that has that rule of thumb, believe what your parents tell you, has no means of distinguishing good advice, like don't walk over a cliff, from bad advice, like spend half your day praying for a juju in the sky. As far as the child brain is concerned, they both sound like parental advice. They both are parental advice. Once the bad advice, spend half your day praying for the juju in the sky, gets started, I won't go into how it started, but it only has to get started. This will go on being passed down the generations, because each child will remember when it has children, pass it on to the next generation. And so you get longitudinal transmission of local traditions of nonsense, which differ from the nonsense in other parts of the world, all fostered by the same psychological predisposition to believe what your parents tell you, which is itself a byproduct of a useful tendency to believe useful things that the parents tell you, and an inability to distinguish the useful advice from the nonsense.